Vayomer Adonai el Moshe bo el Paro, ki ani hichbadti es libo, v'eslev avodav leman, shisi ososai ele bikirbo. And God said to Moshe, go to Paro, because I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his servants, advisors, in order to display my signs that I am giving, the plagues, etc., Bikir Bo, in his midst.
OU Israel presents
in. Welcome.
Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. Your host is Phil Chernofsky, and this issue is for Parshat Bo. Recording and first availability is Thursday, the 2nd of Shvat, 5778. Corresponding this year to January 18. And now, here's Phil.
Thank you, Zari, for that introduction. The only thing I haven't gotten her to be able to say is Yom Chamishi, so I let her get away with Thursday, but the official name, as far as we're concerned, is Yom Chamishi. Okay, let's do Tehillim Kuf Lamed Psalm 130, and then we have a lot to talk about. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai Adonai Shima V'Koli Tihyena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai Imavono Tishmoria Adonai Mia Amod Ki imacha hasalicha lema'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kivita nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mi kol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara v'ashivya ha-omedim ebein bayam Uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, v'yotzi'em mitzara l'yirvacha, u'me'afela la'ora, u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv, v'nomar amen. The opening music, as I'm sure most of the listeners will have recognized, is from the movie Exodus. This particular version is only the beginning. This particular version is by Henry Mancini, and it was my other choice for starting the show. In the past, I've used it, and I've also used the music from the Ten Commandments, and I've been looking, which I haven't found yet, from Moses the Lawgiver with, what's his name, Burt Lancaster as Moses, rather than Charlton Heston. Be that as it may, Parshat Bo is when the Exodus takes place. And I chose to use the theme from Exodus, the movie, even though they were talking about the ship that brought illegal immigrants to Israel. A very, very moving movie. The second of Shvat, I jokingly say, and I think I got it from my father, is Tu B'Shvat. Two, the number two, B'Shvat and Shvat, as opposed to two, made up of the letters Tet Vav, which is pronounced two, and is the 15th of the month, which is Rosh Hashanah La'ilanot, also known as Tu B'Shvat. My father also used to say, instead of the second of Shvat, he would say the tooth of Shvat. In fact, I never bothered looking up, maybe I will one of these days, why first, second, and third have special endings in the abbreviated form, and then fourth, th, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, 11th, 12th, etc., are all th. And then when you get to the 20s, it's 21st, st, and 22nd, nd, and 23rd, rd. Well, we'll look it up, and if it's interesting enough, I'll report it in the future. The second of Shvat is my Zadie's Yortzeit, Yecheskel ben Shmuel. He died 61 years ago when I was a young lad. I have some vague memories of him, and the rest are filled in by stories in the family. And he was one of those, of which there were many, I am sure. He grew up in Poland, in the town of Mizrich. He married there, started a family with three children, who later became two uncles and an aunt of mine. And then he left for the United States, leaving his wife and three children back in Poland in order to earn money to send to them, to bring them to the United States, which he succeeded to do 10 years later or so. So we're talking 1910 or so for his arrival, 1920 for the rest of the family. And then another uncle and my mother, Aleha Shalom, were born in the United States. I don't know what would have happened if he had chosen Land of Israel as a destination, Palestine at that time. That's never come up in family discussions, and I don't know. But I do know that he was a very, very straightforward, honest Jew, religious, and modest, and raised his children well. My Bubby Miriam died early when my mother was 11 years old. So that was, let's say, 12, 13, 14 years after they arrived in the United States. And the rest is family stories, which I'm not going to get into now. But I am thinking of him and had a discussion with my brothers. We all say Kaddish on the Yortzeits of our grandparents. And I finally got a chance to look it up. There are several articles about it on Google, and it has to do with the fact that grandparents and grandchildren often have a close relationship. One of the articles jokingly referred to the comment that they have a common enemy, and it's just something that comes natural depending upon family circumstances. I would not have said Kaddish if my parents were alive, but I feel, as my brothers do, that after they were gone, we should also say Kaddish when there's no one else that's saying Kaddish, except some of our cousins feel the same way. And that's the story. I want to play a track from an old album. I have the vinyl record. I have the cassette tape. I don't know if it's ever been reissued in the more modern forms of recording, like a CD or an MP3. I've actually converted it to an MP3 from the vinyl record. And It features the Magama duo, Moshe Yes, Zichrono Levracha, and Shlomo Levine, Zichrono Levracha. They, one was a, Shlomo was, played the viola, and Moshe Yes, I think, played the guitar. We used to feature them on Motzoi Shabbat entertainment slots at the Israel Center back at 10 Strauss. They were very, very popular, and I would say their most popular song and their most touching song is the one that I'm about to play, which is called My Zadie. Now, even though I started this by saying it was My Zadie's Yahrzeit today, he and the My Zadie of the song are not the same. They have a common denominator that they were both from Poland, but their stories are not the even similar. And yet, there's something very, very touching that in memory of My Zadie and in memory of Shlomo Levine and Moshe Yes, in memory of all three of them, I would like to play My Zadie, and then we'll get down to Parshat Bo.
My Zadie lived with us in my parents' home. He used to laugh, he put me on his knee, and he spoke about his life in Poland. He spoke, but with a bitter memory. And he spoke about the soldiers who would beat him. They laughed at him, they tore his long black coat. And he spoke about a synagogue that they burnt down, and the crying that was heard beneath the smoke. But Zadie made us laugh, Zadie made us sing, and Zadie made a kiddish Friday night. And Zadie, oh my Zadie, how I love him so. And Zadie used to teach me wrong from right. His eyes lit up when he would teach me Torah. He taught me every line so carefully. He spoke about our slavery in Egypt, and how God took us out to make us free. But winter went by, summer came along. I went to camp to run and play. And when I came back home, they said, Zadie's gone, and all his books were packed and stored away. I don't know how or why it came to be. It happened slowly over many years. We just stopped being Jewish like my Zadie was, and no one cared enough to shed a tear. But Zadie made us laugh, Zadie made us sing, and Zadie made us Seder Pesach night. And Zadie, oh my Zadie, how I love him so. And Zadie used to teach me wrong from right. Many winters went by, many summers came along, and now my children sit in front of me. And who will be the Zadie of my children? Who will be their Zadie if not me? Who will be the Zadies of our children? Who will be their Zadies if not we? And Zadie made us laugh, Zadie made us sing, and Zadie made a kiddish Friday night. And Zadie, oh my Zadie, how I love him so. And Zadie used to teach me wrong from right.
Okay, let me start with the first verse that I read before, and specifically the reference to hardening of Pharaoh's heart. When the plagues first began, at each one, the Torah tells us that Paro himself hardened his own heart and refused to let the people go, even though he and his people suffered plague A, B, C, D, etc. When it came around to the sixth plague, we start seeing the Torah telling us that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And that's the beginning of Parshat Bo as well. And the question is obvious, and that is, what happens to free will, which is given to all human beings? If you harden Pharaoh's heart, if God hardens Pharaoh's heart, then he is not making the decision to let the people go or to keep them in. And is that fair? Especially to hold him accountable for it. So there are different approaches, and I like them all. We'll say a few. Number one, you could say, true, God took away Paro's free will, which is usually done when a person dies. If you think about it, people who are incapacitated in some way or another before they die also lost their ability to act, and technically they lose their free will. But usually, when a person is functioning, he has free will. So according to this school of thought, in this case, Paro's free will was actually suspended, as if he was incapacitated, as if he died. He is not held responsible, accountable, for what happens after God hardened his heart. That's not the point. The point was, as it says in the verse, it was in order to go through the full set of plagues, culminating in Makat Bechorot. That was already a given. And we could actually suggest that for the first five plagues, it was his stubbornness that made him renege on his promises. And after that, he lost his free will. Different purpose to it. It's like an exception to the rule. As I said, death ends a person's free will. Incapacitation ends a person's free will. Diminished capabilities limits a person's free will. And in unusual circumstances, God hardening Pharaoh's heart also suspends his free will. That's one school of thought. Another school of thought is exactly the opposite, that God hardening Pharaoh's heart was to maintain his free will. Because when a person is struck down by repeated plagues, one after the other, with the demand of let my people go, if he were to say yes under those circumstances, it would not be a free will decision. If God hardens Pharaoh's heart, giving him the objectivity and clarity of making his decision, not taking into account the difficulties of the plagues, because he is being steeled against those, then he has not the subjective situation of giving in because of repeated beatings, but a free will decision. No, I am not going to let you go, even though I know that another plague is going to come, and another one, I'm not letting you go. And that's his exercise of free will, a totally opposite point of view, and I think there's a lot to it. Now, I said there were a few. I don't really know if I remember offhand any distinction, especially when we're talking about diametrically opposed perspectives on it. So we'll leave it at that. Now, unlike the previous portions of the Torah, which were more or less pure story, important story, telling us who we are, telling us various values that become instinctive within the Jewish way of life, and various and sundry other reasons, it was mostly story. A notable exception was back when God asked Abraham to circumcise himself and the males of his household and his son Ishmael at the time and all future sons at 8 days old. You have a blend of story with mitzvah. But it was a flash at that point. You have it again with Gid HaNasheh. You could even suggest you had it in the first mitzvah of Pru Urevu. But basically, the entire book of Bereishit, 12 weekly sedras, and the first two sedras of Shemot, Shemot and Va'era, were by and large pure story. Comes Bo, the continuation of the story of the plagues in Egypt and the night of the Exodus and the leaving of Egypt. You have in Parshat Bo a healthy blend of story and mitzvah. So we have the mitzvot related to Korban Pesach and to Chametz and Matzah on Pesach and Haggadah and even Bechor, which is a related issue to Egypt, even though it's not as directly related as tell the story of the Exodus on the night of Pesach, but it's mitzvot that come from within the context of the story to the point that we have to have the oral law teach us what elements of the story were only part of the story of that first year of the Exodus, and which elements are part of the mitzvah in perpetuity. For example, the Jews at that night were commanded to slaughter the sheep or the goat, the lamb or the goat, kid, and put its blood on the doorposts and the lintel of their homes. That is not a mitzvah in perpetuity. That was a one-shot deal. The mitzvah of ritually slaughtering the Korban Pesach late afternoon or afternoon of Erev Pesach and roasting it and eating it that night are part of the mitzvah for all generations. But that's another aspect of it. It's the relationship between the story and the story as a context for the commanding of the mitzvot. And we are first seeing it in big in Parshat Bo. Now, as is also well known, especially for those who listen and read Torah tidbits, if I had to pick a favorite mitzvah topic, it would be mitzvah number 4, which is the first mitzvah commanded to the people of Israel, and it is also a mitzvah commanded to the nation rather than to individuals. There will be others, but this is the first. And that is HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. This month, Nisan, which you are getting out of Egypt, shall be the first of your months, meaning you shall establish a calendar according to certain guidelines, and it becomes your national identity to have this calendar with the holidays that are in it. Now, there are many things I say about this and can say about this, but let me say a few things. Number one, God is drawing us into partnership with Him in the concept of sanctity of time. The first demonstration of sanctity of time was God on His own. He created the world in 6 days. He rested on the seventh. And as we read in Parshat Yitro, in the Aseret HaDibrot, Al Kain, Beirach Hashem et Yom HaShabbat, Vayikad Shehu. Therefore, God sanctified the Shabbat and made it holy. God took time, some of it, and sanctified it. Then He commands us to keep the Shabbat and to make it holy. But then, not necessarily in that sequence, He teaches us how to sanctify time. And that is the Jewish calendar and the holidays on the calendar. To put it in a very plain and hard way, every seventh day is Shabbat, whether we welcome it or observe it or escort it out, does not change the fact that it is Shabbat. But if we don't actively create the Jewish calendar, not going into the details of how that has been done, but if we didn't do that, then there wouldn't be a Jewish calendar and there wouldn't be holidays. Pesach exists because we, God's junior partners, sanctified the month of Nisan, and then we follow the Torah that on the 15th is the holiday of Pesach. It is a very important concept, and it is, worthy of being the first mitzvah commanded to the Jewish people before they got out of Egypt and before they stood at Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, to receive the Torah. It's that foundational. Now, speaking of the calendar, I can't not present some element of it. So I will try not to go into the details because they are quite lengthy, but we'll just give the chapter headings here. There are two different methods of establishing the Jewish calendar, and it depends upon whether we have a Sanhedrin, a Supreme High Court, sitting or not. Once upon a time, we had a Sanhedrin. Then we lost it. In Mirtz Hashem, in the future, maybe even the near future, when we will once again have a Sanhedrin and follow what I'll call Plan A. Plan A includes the committee from the Sanhedrin calculating. Today it would be done by information available on the internet. When the moon is going to first be visible, specifically on the night following the 29th of a Jewish moon, sometimes the moon is visible and sometimes not. And that's crucial when we have a Sanhedrin, because they rely on eyewitness testimony to the first visibility of the lunar crescent. So they will calculate that. They will then wait for witnesses. They will question the witnesses. And based on the testimony of the witnesses, the head of the Sanhedrin will declare that day as Rosh Chodesh, as holy. And then whatever takes place during that month has the legitimacy of Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctity of the month. That's Plan A. Another part of Plan A is for a committee of Sanhedrin judges to meet at the beginning of a year after Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, or after Rosh Hashanah, and determine whether that year will have a second Adar or not. Again, I don't want to go into the details, but these are decisions that Sanhedrin makes, and the eyewitness testimony, although not necessary in order to know that the month is beginning, but is necessary to sanctify the month as beginning. I know that didn't sound very clear, but let's not get involved in that now, because I love the topic and I could just keep going on it. Plan B is the one which we have now, and that involves a mathematical formula which you can find in the Rambam and in other sources. You can find computer programs that already follow the rules and can churn out calendars for any year that you want based on calculation. No one has to see the moon. No one has to know the exact moment of the first visibility of the lunar crescent or the instant that the moon is between the earth and the sun. None of that is part of the Plan B. It is purely a mathematical issue, which, with study, anybody can do. But only the Sanhedrin of Hillel, the elder, Hillel HaZaken, set down the formula for all generations without a Sanhedrin, and with the power of that Sanhedrin sanctified all months calculated from the formulas. Now, what I like to point out to people is that Plan A, which will not just be historic, but will be restored with a new Sanhedrin, has a few weaknesses based upon the fact that eyewitness testimony requires clear visibility, and you get a run of cloudy nights in the wintertime, and the moon will not be visible at that early stage of the month. There is a provision for how to handle that, but it's not a perfectly neat system. There are situations where a court might declare Rosh Chodesh erroneously. Witnesses presented themselves, they were questioned, the court was satisfied, and yet the witnesses didn't really see what they claimed to see, for whatever reason, inadvertently or intentionally, and it messes up the calendar. Now, we have provisions for that, too. God has declared, so to speak, that this is our calendar, and that means if we make a mistake, it stays, and he, so to speak, Kiviyochel, changes his calendar to conform to ours because he turned that over to us. So it's not a perfect system, but it has a major plus. Before we get to its major plus, let's take a look at Plan B. Plan B is pretty much a perfect system. Yeah, if you want to get very technical about it, over a very long period of time, there is a slight difference that opens up year after year. But the numbers that we use, specifically the average time it takes the moon to go through its phases, is very, very close to the scientifically calculated average. And the knowledge of which years have two Adars and which have one is neat, it's easy, it works, you could know things in advance. But that system has one big minus. Before I tell you that, let's go back to Plan A with its big plus and give you another one of its minuses. there can be a situation, I don't know if historically it ever happened, that after Purim, which is the middle of Adar, the Sanhedrin decided that there shall be another Adar coming up, not Nisan yet. They make the announcement, and it turns out that you have to do Purim all over again. And not just the reading of Megillah, but Seudat Purim and Mishloach Manot and Matanot Le'Evyonim, in a period of time when people have already started cleaning for Pesach, because Purim was over. And now, a week and a half after Purim, they hear an announcement, next month is Adar, one more time all over again. Not a very neat situation in Plan B, that can't happen. So what's the plus that I'm talking about? Human participation in the process. We, the Jewish people, are commanded to be, as I referred to before, God's active partners, his junior partners, in the sanctification of the calendar, the setting up of the calendar, and whatever it involves. The big minus on Plan B is that we are not active participants. We are observers. We are handed a mathematical formula and told to use it. And I believe this is a way that God has pushed the Jewish people a little bit away at arm's length, so to speak, because our not having a Sanhedrin is not an isolated fact. It comes from a whole deterioration in Torah observance by individuals and, most importantly, by Jewish society. So a punchline of all of this, the bottom line of all of this, is we need to appreciate that Plan B is not the perfect plan, even though it's easier and it works well, because that plus that I spoke about for Plan A and the minus for Plan B are not little technicalities. They are significant parts of the whole picture. So that when we are announcing Rosh Chodesh, the Shabbat before Rosh Chodesh, and the Chazan is using pleasant tunes and everybody joins in, we need to keep in mind that this is not yet the ideal. When we celebrate Rosh Chodesh and we sing Hallel and we have Musaf and we have an extra meal or a special dessert at a meal or a Rosh Chodesh party, we're celebrating. At the same time, we need to keep in mind that this is not the ideal, that we're in this situation because of Avonoteinu Harabim, our many iniquities. And when we say Kiddush Levana, which is another commemorative of this process, and we dance at Kiddush Levana, and Minhag in Israel, and I don't know which other communities have adopted it, to sing Tovim Mi'orot and dance around, that a little part of us should realize that we are dancing with Plan B, which is not the ideal. We consider Kiddush Levana to be receiving the face of the Shechina, so to speak, Kabbalat Pnei HaShechina, but it is not the ideal for our calendar. And we need to keep that in mind, because what goes along with those melancholy thoughts is the tzfiyah for the Geula, pining away, looking forward to, praying for, anticipating the complete redemption, which includes the Sanhedrin. Now, on a technical note, the Sanhedrin of the future will have things available to it that past Sanhedrins did not, mostly in the field of notification. You need not send bonded messengers by horseback. You need not have bonfires lit from hilltop to hilltop to notify people. You have a live internet broadcast and emails that are sent out to shul lists and whatever else is necessary to tell them when Pesach is, when Purim is, how many Adars there are, when Rosh Chodesh is and was, and that's going to be different. But the basics of eyewitness testimony are going to be there. And one should never think that we have, that they, in the olden times, had eyewitness testimony because they didn't know when the moon was going to reappear. That's baloney. The new moon was well known in ancient times, as it is today. And among the people, some know it better than others. But the Sanhedrin were experts at that. And yet, that human participation is what God prefers and what he wants. On that note, I will wish you, even though there's plenty more to Parshat Bo, I will wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameya.
Ma bevayze koyn sosoyn ve koyn simcho yehi hakhoyde shaze kin evu asav khoyze mishma bevayze koyn sosoyn ve koyn simcho khozok yemahalei mishaloyse Bakosho seinu Chozok mimahalei Mishaloi seinu Amit yase Bakosho seinu Yehi hachodesh hazeh Hinevu asa vichoizeh Nishama bevayizeh Show say